Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Topping the news, the U.S. and India's relationship moves to a new level. President Barack Obama and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi broke a deadlock on a long-stalled nuclear pact today, with both leaders noting their friendship as the catalyst for closer diplomatic ties. Within hours of arriving in New Delhi, the U.S. leader said he and Mr. Modi have agreed to deepen their defense and security cooperation. Mr. Obama is in India for 3 days, during which he will become the first American leader to attend the country's Republic Day ceremony. At a news conference today, Mr. Obama was also asked about the situation in Ukraine, where an attack on the port city of Mariupol has killed at least 30 and wounded more than 80. Mr. Obama said he will increase pressure on Moscow.
We are deeply concerned about the latest break in the ceasefire and the aggression that these separatists, with Russian backing, Russian equipment, Russian financing, Russian training, and Russian troops, are conducting. And we will continue to take the approach that we've taken in the past, which is to ratchet up the pressure on Russia.
Mr. Obama and European leaders are already threatening new sanctions on Russia after pro-Russian rebels launched their attack on Mariupol. Mr. Obama said he will use all available resources except for military intervention. The Pakistan military, meantime, says it has bombed suspected militant hideouts in North Waziristan, killing at least 35 militants. Officials in Nigeria say fighting is breaking out with troops attacking Boko Haram militants in the Borno state capital of Maiduguri and the town of Magudo. They say coordinated air and land operations are being conducted against the simultaneous attacks. The fighting left many dead and a curfew imposed in Maiduguri. Officials say Boko Haram took control. This is VOA News. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has called the apparent beheading of a Japanese captive by the Islamic State group outrageous and impermissible. The Japanese leader told public broadcaster NHK today that Japan will not give in to terrorism and call for the immediate release of the remaining Japanese captive, freelance journalist Kenji Goto. The statements come a day after the IS group posted a video online showing Goto holding up photos appearing to show his captive, self-employed security contractor Haruna Nakawa, beheaded. Greek voters are casting ballots to elect a new parliament, with opinion polls showing they could leave a leftist party in power. VOA's Al Pessin reports.
The Greek election campaign has been largely focused on this man, Alexis Tsipras, whose enthusiastic supporters have lifted his Syriza party from 5% a few years ago to about 30% now.
Give us a mandate to rule so we can put an end to the catastrophic bailouts and to be able to negotiate.
But Syriza is not likely to win a majority and may not even emerge as the largest party in parliament. That may be New Democracy, the current coalition leader led by Prime Minister Antonis Samaras. And either one of them will likely need a coalition partner from the left. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
World leaders are descending on Saudi Arabia to pay respects following the death of King Abdullah. The 90-year-old king died Friday after a lengthy hospitalization with pneumonia. President Barack Obama will cut short his visit to India to attend the memorials. The president called the new king, Salman bin Abdul Aziz, on Saturday to personally express his sympathies. The White House said King Salman welcomed the news that Mr. Obama would be coming to Riyadh to express them in person. Others offering their condolences in person and arriving now are the British Prince Charles, Prime Minister David Cameron, French President Francois Hollande, and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was among the Muslim leaders who attended the king's funeral and burial Friday in Riyadh. Edgar Lungu has been sworn in as Zambia's sixth president after narrowly winning the vote. The Election Commission said Mr. Lungu of the ruling Patriotic Front won 48.3% of the vote. His closest rival from the United Party for National Development finished second, with 46.7% of the vote. The opposition is alleging the election, which ended on Saturday, was stolen and does not reflect the will of the people of Zambia. The election was triggered by the death in October of President Michael Sata. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. There's more news on our website, voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
International community, the African Union, and the other members of the negation are doing really their best to make sure that the peace process continues.
The African Union condemns the latest violence in Mali. We'll have details.
I think it's only fair and respectful that we keep certain cultures alive, because most of these folks there is are part of the tapestry.
A Nigerian lady creates a mobile phone application to preserve the African tradition of oral folk stories.
Unfortunately, that conclusion was borne out by the Ebola outbreak that we are seeing. Now, Ebola 2014 is truly unprecedented in terms of the highest number of people affected.
And the World Economic Forum moves to address the West Africa Ebola outbreak. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Edgar Lungu, candidate for Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front, was installed as the new president on Sunday. The Electoral Commission of Zambia declared him winner of the January 20 presidential by-election. For the latest update, Richard Mulonga, a freelance journalist, joins us live via telephone link up. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And how are you doing in Lusaka?
We are fine here in Lusaka. The president has been sworn in. He's in State House now. And he had a lunch on for some of his guests. And everything is peaceful. The celebrations are toning down, and people are getting back to business.
Now he named one second. He names Amos Chanda as his press secretary. How soon did he say, or do Zambians expect the new president to name his cabinet?
The president has already appointed his cabinet. So tomorrow at 9 hours Zambian time, he's going to swear in these ministers. But he has kept the list to his chest, and it's only tomorrow when we'll know who is who in his cabinet.
Now, I understand opposition UPND leader Hakainde Hichilema boycotted today's swearing-in, although a representative from his party attended the ceremony. Were there any notable absentees at the swearing-in today?
Well, Hakainde Hichilema is the biggest fish that didn't pitch up. Although we don't know whether we could say he snubbed the event, because he sent his national campaign manager Deepak Patel. So it's arguable that the UPND was represented, but you know it would have made much impact if Hakainde Hichilema himself was present at the inauguration ceremony. But the fact that he wasn't there, people are beginning to say that he snubbed the event, and the presence of the UPND at the inauguration ceremony was very subtle, because they sent the campaign manager, not the party president himself. Because if Hakainde Hichilema was present there, it was going to show his magnanimity in defeat, and you know it was going to add that flavor of peace and unity.
How are Zambians reacting to the swearing-in of Edgar Lungu?
Well, they generally, Lusaka in particular, and parts of the country where the Patriotic Front is present, these places have been characterized with celebrations from last evening when the announcement was made. I understand that some people actually went to the National Stadium where they spent a night to wait for the inauguration ceremony. And specifically, peace and unity has been the characteristic of this event, and this has continued up to now.
Obviously, the UPND is not happy about how events turned out. They have 2 weeks by Zambia's electoral law to go to the Supreme Court, to petition the Supreme Court to seek redress. Have they indicated they will do this?
Not at all. They haven't made any public pronouncement in that regard, although they are free to go and contest. But we really don't expect the UPND to go to court, because the judicial process really takes quite long, and there are all these turns and twists. So we expect the UPND to just start preparing for 2016, where they could explore their prospects of forming government. I don't really think that the UPND would think of going to seek a court redress.
Thank you very much, Richard. Richard Mulonga is a freelance journalist in Zambia. He just joined us live from the capital, Lusaka. The African Union mission to Mali in the Sahel has condemned the ongoing violence in Mali's north and urged all parties, including Tuareg rebels, not to abandon peace talks. Colonel Mo Mbo, the head of the security unit at the African Union mission for Mali and the Sahel, told me that there is need to end the spate of violence in Mali.
You know that the AU is fully involved in the peace process that is led by Algeria. We are part of the negotiation, and the head of the African Union mission in Mali and the Sahel is, as I said, fully involved in the peace process. The second thing is that we are part of the what we call the technical security commission, and the technical security commission has met several times. Our last meeting was on the 15th of January, and this was in fact to make sure that the ceasefire is respected. So we are part of all the process that are aimed at really the cessation of the hostilities on the ground.
These Tuaregs have threatened to pull out of the talks, which some people think could create another round of instability. What is your take on that?
No, I'm not. I don't believe that the peace talks will be stopped. And I think the international community, the African Union, and the other members of the negotiation are doing really their best to make sure that the peace process continues.
There is currently an ongoing instability there. I know the AU has expressed concern and has issued a statement condemning it. What does this entail?
You know, the international community condemned the violence that are going on in north of Mali, and you know that the ceasefire was obtained by the president of the African Union on the 23rd of May. So I think the AU is doing its best to make sure that the ceasefire is respected. The only thing that we think really should go now is the peace talks. We need to resume the peace talks, and as I said, the members of the negotiation is doing whatever they can to make sure that the people come back on the table.
So going forward, what is the AU going to do to help this peace process move forward?
I think the African Union is part of the negotiation team. The African Union Peace and Security Council has met several times to encourage the peace process to continue. And I think the African Union is at the level of the Commission, but also at the level of the Peace and Security Council, is working with other partners, with the lead of the mediation team to make sure that we reach an agreement.
What would be your message to the people in Mali?
I think the message is really to stop violence and to go back to the negotiation process.
Colonel Mo Mbo is the head of the security unit at the African Union mission for Mali and the Sahel. He spoke with me from the Malian capital, Bamako. Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete announced a cabinet reshuffle Saturday after Energy and Minerals Minister Sos Peter Muhongo resigned over allegations of corruption. For the latest update, Absalom Kibanda, the group managing editor at New Habari Media, an independent Tanzanian publication, joins us live via telephone link up. Hello, Absalom.
Hello.
Well, Absalom, let me ask you, did President Kikwete give reasons for this rather sudden cabinet reshuffle?
Actually, it's not a sudden one because it was expected, because after the resolution at the parliament that he was supposed to sack some ministers whose names were mentioned in the escrow scandal last December. So this cabinet reshuffle has been late, it's been expected by many. So we were waiting to see who will take over from Professor Muhongo, who was the Minister for Energy, whose name was mentioned in the escrow scandal over the corruption allegation, as you said. And prior to that, the other Minister for Land had resigned already, by Professor Tibaijuka. So two ministers were out of his cabinet. So he was bound to make some reshuffle. So it was expected.
How are Tanzanians reacting to this?
Actually, there have been mixed feelings from Tanzanians. The leaders of opposition have already denounced, saying that this is recycling. There's nothing new in peculiar. Of course, two new faces have come in the cabinet, but not as full ministers, but as deputy ministers. But he has picked some old guys in his cabinet, moving from one minister portfolio to the other. So that's why the opposition say that they are not slightly sure that this reshuffle could make any sensible change they expected. So there's a lot of criticism out of it, because maybe people expected much from Kikwete, but he went on just leaving only those two ministers who resigned them over their names being mentioned in the escrow scandal.
Talking about the escrow scandal, the opposition parties, including Chadema, have said the ruling CCM is not committed to fighting corruption. But ruling party supporters are saying the reshuffle shows the party wants to weed out graft. What is your take?
Actually, my take is the government has been forced by the parliament. It is not being done out of its willingness. So the opposition are right that actually the government is not fulfilling what it said, that the resignation of two ministers came out of pressure and force, not only within opposition, yes, even within CCM itself. So there was a force, and CCM bounced back to the people's demands. So it did not come out of the willingness of the government or the ruling party.
This escrow scandal appeared to have given the CCM a little black eye, as some people will say. Will this scandal hurt the chances of the CCM to win the next election, although they have dominated the political scene since independence?
Actually, we cannot say yet, because this time the coming October election will be very difficult to CCM to win. So there's no... an obvious term is how it used to be 5 years, 10 years back. Anything could happen this year, because a lot of people have been challenging, have been questioning of the integrity and the strength of CCM is how it used to be. So it's not certainly sure to say that CCM is going to win this election, because there's also a lot of tensions within CCM itself. So maybe the history could be written in Tanzania, whereby it's possible that for the first time in history, opposition can take over from CCM.
Thank you very much, Absalom Kibanda. Kibanda is the group managing editor at Habari Media, an independent Tanzania publication. He joins us live from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. In the age of smartphones and mobile technology, some Africans worry that oral traditions will be lost to internet connections and social media. This has led one Nigerian woman to create a mobile phone application as a way to preserve folk stories. For VOA, Christian Robbie has the story from Abidjan.
For centuries, Africans have preserved their history through storytelling. But communication is evolving as more and more Africans use smartphones. So Nigerian tech entrepreneur and fashion designer Elizabeth Kapurin decided to adapt African folk tales to the 21st century, and she's focusing on children's stories that teach moral lessons. She created Afro Tales, a mobile application to preserve some of the stories told to her when she was a child sitting around the campfires at her home in eastern Benue State.
Sometimes you can't teach a child something by just telling the child, don't do this, don't do this. It, in fact, it gave me context and a story. Somebody stole something and then something bad happened to that person. Alternatively, somebody else did something good and the person ended up really happy or really rich.
Hello, children. My name is Liz and I would like to tell you a story about a tortoise, an elephant and a hippopotamus. This story will tell you why it is important to go to school so you can grow up to be very wise like the tortoise in the story.
Afro Tales is designed for children ages 2 to 10. The voice of Aunt Liz narrates the story while a full screen animation appears. An arrow indicates when it's time to move on. There are also quizzes on object recognition and counting throughout.
Can you point at Mr. Elephant? No, try again. Good! Find the rope. No, try again.
Capern relied on her older relatives to help collect Teve stories from an ethnic group of 4 million people in southeast Nigeria and northwest Cameroon. Eventually, she would like to include folktales from other parts of Nigeria in various local languages.
I want to keep it centered around folk stories. I don't want popular stories like, let's say, the ones that Walt Disney has made really, really popular. I think it's only fair and respectful that we keep certain cultures alive, because most of these folk stories are part of the tapestry that keeps cultures together.
Capern is responsible for voicing and script writing. Her partner and husband, Adimebi Elamina Eremi, does the animation, a love story sparked during their creation of the app. Afro Tales is available for Android users and can be downloaded for free on the Google Play Store. So far, Afro Tales has more than 50,000 users. Funding has been a major challenge, so Capern hopes to capitalize on the popularity of the first installment with a crowdfunding campaign. Capern says technology doesn't have to destroy or replace tradition. Her mission is to blend the two to keep African culture alive.
Africa is our home, you know. I think we are so in a rush to become Western that we're forgetting things that are really, really important, things that should be part of who we are. And I don't think that's right.
The second Afro Tales is due to be released early this year. Kristen Roby for VOA News, Abidjan.
The World Economic Forum has addressed the West Africa Ebola outbreak at this year's meeting in Davos, Switzerland. Experts discussed the response to the epidemic and the best ways to respond to future catastrophic disease outbreaks. VOA's Jody Kapwa reports.
The start of the West Africa Ebola outbreak has been traced to a two-year-old child in a remote area of Guinea. She became infected in December 2013, but her case was not discovered until March of 2014. Since then, there have been well over 21,000 cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, with the number of deaths nearing 9,000. At the World Economic Forum, President Alpha Conde of Guinea, through an interpreter, spoke about the outbreak.
The speed at which Ebola has spread surprised the world, which was not at all prepared to fight Ebola.
Mr. Conde said there was little understanding of the disease.
One didn't explain to the patients that Ebola is a very, very serious epidemic, but that one can be cured from Ebola. International communication was disastrous, because it was more panic creating than anything else. International mobilization only really took place as of September last year, but now we know exactly what has to be done to fight against Ebola, and we know what it is.
He said it is now clear that the chain of transmission must be stopped. Infected persons must be treated early and kept from having contact with others for 21 days. But Mr. Conde criticized border closings, saying the measure caused many problems within the affected countries, such as fear and economic loss. While Ebola vaccine trials advance, Mr. Conde said under different circumstances, a vaccine would already exist.
The market is a weak market. We let poor people die. If Ebola was a disease of the developed countries, then we would have found a vaccine by now, and that is not the case.
World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan also spoke at the World Economic Forum. The WHO has been sharply criticized for its initial slow response to the outbreak. Dr. Chan said in 2011, a group of independent experts concluded the world was not prepared for a severe and sustained disease outbreak.
Unfortunately, that conclusion was borne out by the Ebola outbreak that we are seeing. Now, Ebola 2014 is truly unprecedented in terms of the highest number of people affected and so many of them die. It is truly a tragedy. And also, it is unprecedented in terms of its geographical spread. 9 countries in 3 continents were affected over reporting cases to WHO. And of course, this is also an outbreak that is lasting the longest period.
She said 3 areas of response need to be strengthened.
Number 1, the health system capacity and preparedness. Do they have the people, the infrastructure, and the system to detect disease early? Second point, the international response need to be much better coordinated.
And third, she said there's much that remains lacking in the fight against Ebola.
Ebola has been around for 40 years, and yet we are empty-handed in terms of vaccine, drugs, diagnostic, to make the diagnosis sooner, to isolate patients and treat them well, and at the same time do the proper contact tracing to stop the transmission of the diseases.
Dr. Chan said people expect the WHO to be the first responder to a health crisis. She said, however, it needs to do a better job of communicating about what it can and cannot do. She said the WHO will find ways to be better prepared. The World Economic Forum session on combating outbreaks was moderated by Dr. Peter Piot. He co-discovered the Ebola virus in 1976.
It will only be over when the last person with Ebola is either dead or recovered without having infected other people. So that's quite a daunting task. Predicting the future, as we all know, is very difficult, but one thing is sure, there will be other Ebola outbreaks and there will be other epidemics, not the least influenza.
The WHO says flu epidemics cause up to 5 million severe illnesses every year and up to a 500,000 deaths. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, I'm Sunday Shomari. Next on Let's Talk, In Lows. In Lows is a topic we'll discuss in our new light-hearted show, Let's Talk. So join me, Sunday Shomari, and my guests as we explore In Lows with some hilarity. That's Let's Talk, Monday at 17:30 UTC. Right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Zambians have elected their next president following the sudden death of Michael Sata. We'll discuss the results and the copper-producing nation's future. Next time on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the African Nations Cup continues today in Equatorial Guinea. Abdu Shakur Abud of the VOA Kiswahili service is currently covering the football fiesta in the West African country and has this report.
Peter, the situation here is tense and excitement. In Bata, the main stadium, which is the biggest in the country, sits 40,000 people and it is sold out. When Gabon will meet the host of the African Cup of Nations 2015, Equatorial Guinea. The situation is that this is the first time in history, according to officials of CAF, that they have reached a situation where they do not know at this time in point which team is going to the quarterfinals or which team is packing its bag and go. So today's game between Gabon and Equatorial Guinea and Congo and Burkina Faso will give us the first two teams to go into the quarterfinals. We have seen so many draws in these finals that if in case there is a draw, what next? Will CAF take a decision to count the goals? Or will there be a lottery? And that's a big challenge, and it's the question on everybody's mind. Because all the groups, A, B, C, and D, we do not know who is moving forward for the quarterfinals or who is packing. Each and every team, this is the first time they're saying, is trying to win a game. So it's an atmosphere of the final games of African Cup, because they say in the past, when we reach at this time, some team starts negotiating with other team, asking for favors, don't win, don't lose, so that we can move forward. But this time, each one is fighting for their own life. So the situation is very interesting, and everybody is excited here in Bata. The stadium is going to be full, and we are going to watch this critical match, which is going to play in Bata and Ebebinyi. So let's wait and see what the outcome will be by 9 o'clock local time.
Thank you very much, Shakur. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, January 25th. The last round of day two matches at the ongoing 2015 Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Equatorial Guinea were played on Saturday. Day three matches kick off today, Sunday, with two matches in Group A. The dual final day two matches on Saturday ended 1-1. Ivory Coast snagged a late equalizer to hold Mali 1-1, while Cameroon's match against Guinea produced the same scoreline as the draws continued to flow in a remarkably even tournament. We'll dwell more on that later. Mali, semi-finalists in the last two Nations Cup, broke a sequence of six matches without scoring against his bigger neighbor when Bakary Sako fired home a superb volley from Sambu Yatabare's cross in the seventh minute. The Eagles, who also considered a late goal in their 1-1 draw with Cameroon, then resisted 18 minutes of Ivorian dominance before finally capitulating when Marc Gradel leveled with 3 minutes to play. For its part, Cameroon took an early lead against Guinea when Benjamin Mokanjo scored direct from a corner, although the ball was helped into the net by goalkeeper Nabi Yatara. Ibrahima Traore equalized 3 minutes before halftime when he received the ball with his back to goal and, despite the attention of a pack of defenders, turned and fired a low shot into the far corner from 25 meters. Cameroon, unbeaten in 9 games since its dismal World Cup performance, missed 2 clear chances in the second half, while Guinea had a stoppage time penalty appeal turned down. As I reported earlier, results so far at the 38th edition of the two-yearly tournament have been remarkably even. 10 of the 16 matches so far have produced draws, while all 4 matches so far in Group D have ended 1-1. Group D could even be decided by the drawing of lots if the 2 final matches on Wednesday, that is Cameroon versus Ivory Coast and Guinea versus Mali, are drawn by the same scoreline. After the first 2 matches in each of the 4 groups, here now are the standings. Group A, Congo-Brazzaville leads with 4 points, followed by Gabon on 3, Post-Equatorial Guinea on 2, and Burkina Faso on 1. Burkina Faso, the 2013 runner-up, faces an early elimination from the 2015 tournament. Group B, Tunisia leads with 4 points, followed by Cape Verde and the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo, with 2 points each. Zambia, the 2012 Nations Cup winner, is last on 1 point. In the final group match on Monday, Cape Verde goes against Zambia, while DR Congo tackles Tunisia. Group C, Senegal is on top with 4 points, one more than Ghana and Nigeria on 3 points each, while South Africa is glued to the bottom on just 1 point. In the final Group C match on Tuesday, South Africa takes on Ghana in a must-win match if the former is to advance, while Senegal meets Algeria in a potentially explosive tie. And Group D, all the 4 teams, Cameroon, Guinea, Ivory Coast and Mali, are on 2 points apiece. The teams will seek to break the deadlock in their final group matches on Wednesday. The fixture is Cameroon versus Ivory Coast and Guinea versus Mali. Meanwhile, ahead of Tuesday's decisive clash between Ghana and South Africa, the West Africans are keeping their feet on the ground after a dramatic win over Algeria on Friday. A win over South Africa on Tuesday will guarantee the Black Stars of Ghana passage to the last 8 of the competition. But if Ghana draws and Algeria fails to beat Senegal on the same night, the Black Stars could still advance from the group stage. Ghana coach Avram Grant said his new generation of Black Stars aim to do the business against a South African team that has impressed him. Nothing has been decided yet in this group, insisted the former Chelsea manager. Yes, we may have beaten the number one team in Africa, but we now face South Africa, who qualified for this tournament ahead of a big team like Nigeria. They played very well in their first game, even though they eventually lost to Algeria. They are a fantastic team, he said. Meanwhile, Marseille star Andre Ayew has declared that Ghana should not be written off as a genuine contender at the Nations Cup, despite not yet finding its best form. This is not the best Ghana. Many of us, like John and I, are not 100% fit, but we can do a lot more, he said. The Black Stars last won the Nations Cup in 1982, although they have reached the last 4 of the previous 4 editions. In a related development, South Africa coach Ephraim Sheikh Mashaba is not giving up hope on his side's chances of qualifying for the last 8. South Africa must beat Ghana in their last match in Mungomo on Tuesday to stand any chance of progressing to the last 8. We are still in contention. We can still surprise a lot of people. We should have scored at least 6 goals in our 2 matches, Mashaba said. Now, this interesting story from Equatorial Guinea, where 16 teams are featuring in the 2015 Nations Cup finals. The Congo squad found an unlikely savior when the team bus broke down in a forest and they were rescued by Burkina Faso, the same team that the Congolese meet in their final group match today, Sunday. French radio reported that the Congo players needed to hitch a ride on the way from Bata to Ebebi for their final Group A game. Traveling along the same road was the Burkina Faso bus, which was almost empty as their players had been put into more comfortable minibuses for the 3-hour journey. The near-empty bus then picked up the Congo players and delivered them to their destination after a delay of only 1 hour. Earlier in the competition, Congo coach Claude Leroy had complained bitterly about the team bus because it had no air conditioning. Well, it seems now that Leroy was right after all. Finally, not everyone is complaining about the facilities and transportation problems at the Nations Cup. Coach Abi Renard of Ivory Coast says Equatorial Guinea has done well in hosting the tournament. He says the 15,000 capacity stadium in the capital city of Malabo is lovely. The Central African nation had just 2 months to prepare for the tournament after original host Morocco pulled out over Ebola fears. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Clote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports. Nightline Africa Sports. All right, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
She's a rich girl. She don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. She's a poor boy, empty as a pocket, empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing ta-na-na, ta-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Ta-na-na, ta-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. 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 Poor boy. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. She's crazy, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Well, that's one way to lose these walking blues. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. She's physically forgotten, but then she slipped into my pocket with my car keys. She said, you've taken me for granted because I please you. Where are these diamonds? And I could say, ooh, as if everybody knows what I'm talking about. As if everybody here know exactly what I was talking about. Talk about diamonds on the soles of the shoes. Safe for his ordinary shoes. She said, honey, take me dancing, but they ended up by sleeping in a doorway by the bodegas and the lights on off of Broadway, wearing diamonds on the soles of their shoes. And I could say, about. I mean, everybody here know exactly what I was talking about. Talking about diamonds. Diamonds on the soles of our shoes. Na 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 na
When my shaman, whoop on Comboti.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa. Here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is incredible to believe that some African politicians and public policy makers lack the ability to learn from momentous events. For them, the old saying that it is a wise man that learns from his experience, but a wiser man that learns from the experience of others has no particular relevance. Only a few months ago, the long-serving president of Burkina Faso, Blaise Compaoré, was ousted from power by the people of his country when he was foolish enough to attempt an amendment of the Constitution to prolong his already long rule. Many commentators argued at that time that that development in Burkina Faso would serve as a bitter lesson for African politicians and leaders. What was not taken into account was the fact that African politicians can be exceedingly resourceful in devising schemes and strategies to gain political power and to hold on to it for as long as possible. In this regard, supporters of the President of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, Joseph Kabila, prepared and tabled a draft bill on electoral law. The bill would call for a national census and added that the census should be completed before the presidential election, which normally should be held in 2016. The students and other protesters saw the trick that by linking the census with the election, the intent was to prolong the rule of President Kabila, who should actually vacate his office with 2 terms. It was made clear that it would take at least 1 year, that is by the government assessment, for the census to be completed. But others said that realistically, it would take 3 years. This was the reason why we had 4 days of bloody confrontation in many cities in the DRC. A bishop of the DRC joined the fray and called on the government to drop the link between the census and the election. The Senate of the DRC, perhaps trying to prevent further bloodshed, last Friday decided to amend the electoral bill and to delink the election with the national census. This was done unanimously. The students were jubilant, and they suggested that they have achieved an historic victory. But one should be more careful. The bill passed by the Senate would now be negotiated with the lower house, and then the lower house would have to vote on the bill. It is possible that the lower house could insist on its own version of the bill. While this could be unwise, there is a precedent in the sense that the lower house in 2010 did ignore changes by the Senate and voted for its own version of the bill. So we have to see what the developments would be. It is easy enough to discern why the politicians in the DRC are so desperate. It is true that President Kabila is still a young man, and with no clearly discernible professional credentials, it is difficult to see what he would do after he leaves office. He has been thrust into the presidency when his father, Laurent Désiré Kabila, was assassinated under mysterious circumstances in 2001. Even his father himself was brought into power by a coalition of forces in the successful effort to remove the dictator Mobutu. African leaders tend to stay in power when they are not certain of what they would do professionally after they have left office. But the new generation of African youth are determined to spare no effort to insist that African presidents follow the country's constitution. That is to say, not to seek a change of the constitution. A similar attempt, as was done in the DRC, was tried recently in Nigeria when it was suggested that owing to the security concerns, they should postpone the election, which was scheduled for next month. That was turned down. What Africa needs is for a regular change of government, as we are now seeing in Zambia. I thank you.
Thank you very much. And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and engineer for today, Brian McCullier, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, it is better to be a lion for a day than a sheep your entire life. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A top leader of the ruthless armed group that for decades has terrorized a large area of Central Africa is now in custody of an international tribunal to face charges for war crimes and crimes against humanity. The United States welcomes Dominic Ongwen's transfer to the International Criminal Court as an important step toward justice for victims of the Lord's Resistance Army. Ongwen, 34, defected from the LRA in early January. In announcing his transfer to the ICC, the United Nations Security Council called on states to bring the group's remaining commanders to justice, including its leader, Joseph Kony. And the UN urged an immediate end to all attacks by the LRA, release of all those abducted, and its fighters to disarm and demobilize. Abducted as a child, Ongwen allegedly went on to commit and direct brutal crimes over many years as one of the group's senior commanders, including attacks on displaced civilians in northern Uganda and the massacre of more than 300 civilians in Makombo, Democratic Republic of the Congo, by elements reportedly under his command. We commend the efforts of all those involved in Ongwen's transfer, including the African Union Anti-LRA Task Force, for its significant efforts that laid the groundwork for Ongwen's removal from the battlefield, President Museveni and the government of Uganda for their sustained leadership in the regional efforts to end the LRA threat, and the Central African Republic's transitional president, Catherine Samba Panza, whose actions have exemplified her deep commitment to ending impunity in the CAR and ensuring that the perpetrators of atrocities are held accountable. We also thank those individuals in the CAR whose actions made it possible for Ongwen to face justice, and we call on all citizens of LRA-affected areas to continue their efforts to support the forces combating the LRA in the region. These developments give hope to the survivors, to the four countries affected by the LRA, and to their partners around the world, that the nightmare of the LRA can be brought to an end.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.